Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 481, titled An Interview with John Buchanan. This is being recorded on October 9th of the year 2004. Recall before we begin our interview with John Buchanan that all of these programs are being archived on Real Audio by sister station WFMU-FM, more recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only on another URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. The Spitfire website has long written annotated descriptions of these various programs and links all over the place running to a website that was inspired by John Buchanan's work that features the various documents linking the Bush family to Nazi industry online. And also the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is available for download for free on the Spitfire website, as well as a search function and all kinds of other goodies as well. So do not neglect the Spitfire website. Now, my guest in this broadcast is John Buchanan, a very courageous independent journalist from the Northeast. And John is known to this audience as the author of a number of articles that appeared in the New Hampshire Gazette, talking about the Bush family's connections to Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. John Buchanan, welcome to our airwaves.
Dave, thank you very much for having me, and I thank you for having me on and giving me a chance to speak to your listeners, because I greatly respect your courage in bringing to the awareness of American people the stuff that you know about that I don't know about. So between the two of us, we ought to be a real threat to George W. Bush tonight.
Well, we'll see what we can do here. Now, you are known to the audience as the author of New Hampshire Gazette articles. We'll touch on those in a minute. John, if you would just briefly outline your background for the members of the
I'm from the Civil War town of Petersburg, Virginia. I come from a military family, and I'm the grandson of a Methodist minister. I've been a journalist and investigative reporter since early 1970, and I've worked in every major media market in the country, most notably New York, Los Angeles, Washington, and Miami. And in addition to being a print journalist, I've been news director of an ABC television station and program director of an ABC News radio station. And all I have ever cared about and all I have ever done for a living is to try to report truth that I think is important to the public debate.
How did you come to be investigating the focal point of the New Hampshire Gazette articles, namely the Bush family's
The really amazing thing about the story is that I decided after 34 years as a journalist in the late spring of 2003, after living in Miami for almost 7 years, that I actually wanted to become a movie screenwriter and move back to Los Angeles and write movie scripts. And so what actually happened was that at the website TakeBackTheMedia.com, I saw a flash movie entitled Bush is Not a Nazi, So Stop Saying So. And I looked at the flash movie, and it said that the family profited from slave labor at Auschwitz and so on. And then, quite frankly, my mind couldn't really embrace the fact that it could be true. But I concocted a movie script called Project Clear Vision, having to do with the anthrax letters after the 9/11 attacks, and I tied it back to the Bush Nazi history and I.G. Farben. I submitted the script in the end of August of last year to a very good movie agent in Los Angeles. His name is Brad Rosenfeld at an agency called Preferred Artists. The Tuesday after Labor Day last year, he called me up and said that he and his colleagues had read the script and that I had written a great movie script that they could sell for a lot of money, but there was one problem with it, and that was that I would have to go prove the Nazi past of the Bush family. I took a deep breath and I said to Brad, you know, I have no idea if that's even possible because I found this on a website. I have no idea whether it's true or not. I just thought it was an interesting justification for a movie script. He said, well, unless you can go prove it, I can never even show this script to anyone. People would be terrified and run from it. So I got online and I did my homework very quickly and I tracked down the fact that the records of the U.S. Office of the Alien Property Custodian, which seized Nazi assets after the U.S. entered the war, was restored at the National Archives Annex in College Park, Maryland. So I got on the phone as a reporter, not as a screenwriter, and I spoke with a woman actually at the Library of Congress whose name was Christine Blackerby. And she told me that not only did the documents exist at the National Archives, but that she had personal direct knowledge of additional documents that existed in the personal papers of W. Averill Harriman, the late former governor of New York State, who was also the infamous peace negotiator during the Vietnam peace negotiations under Nixon. I went 2 weeks later on September 17th to the National Archives, and in 1 8-hour day on September 17th, I was able to find and copy all of the documents that corroborated the seizures of the five Bush-managed Nazi front businesses that were seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act beginning in August of 1942 with Hamburg American Line, the shipping line, and found a proof that Prescott Bush had been a stockholder in and day-to-day management of this web of Nazi front businesses for the Nazi industrialist Fritz Thyssen, who was the steel and coal baron who was Hitler's original patron and whose autobiography was entitled I Paid Hitler.
Right, now this, by the way, is September 17th is of 2003, correct?
2003, correct.
Alrighty. Now, the subject of the Bush family's involvement with Nazi business is something that's familiar to many members of our audience, but for people that might be new and for purposes of review and overview, I wonder if you could briefly detail the main businesses and how Prescott Bush and his father-in-law, George Herbert Walker, respectively, by the way, the grandfather and great-grandfather of the current seated President of the United States, explain how they relate to them, and also if you could bring Alan Dulles into that mix.
Okay. What happened was George Herbert Walker, for whom Daddy Bush is named, was essentially the Donald Trump of his time. He was a very wealthy businessman from St. Louis who moved to Wall Street in the early 1920s. And he met W. Averill Harriman, and they became partners. George Herbert Walker had G.H. Walker and Company on Wall Street, and W. A. Harriman had a Harriman Investment Corp.
By the way,
and
just
they became partners, and in 1923, they were an introduction by the Warburgs, by the way, Max and Paul Warburg, who were other major industrial forces in the Nazi war machine. The Warburgs set up a meeting in Berlin in 1923, and George Herbert Walker and Averill Harriman went to Berlin and met with Fritz Thyssen, who had already decided to back Hitler and had made his first financial contribution to Hitler to build the Nazi Party. Apparently, from the limited historical record that exists, Fritz Thyssen had already decided to hedge his bets. He was the wealthiest man in Germany, and along with another man named Friedrich Flick, who also had significant industrial interests, they ultimately formed what was called the German Steel Trust and built, by and large, the entire Nazi war machine. In late 1923, in that meeting in Berlin, Fritz Thyssen asked Walker and Harriman to form a financial entity in New York City that would handle all of his operations outside of Germany. It was called Union Banking Corporation, which came to be known as UBC. And UBC was really not a bank. It was a money laundering organization for a web of Nazi front businesses that included more than a dozen businesses, but the primary ones, all of which were operated out of the same small suite of offices at 39 Broadway, which Walker, and then 2 years later, Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current president, managed, along with Roland Harriman, who was the younger brother of W. Averill Harriman, were a Union Banking Corporation, another investment company called Holland American Trading Corp, another business called Seamless Steel and Equipment Corp, a shipping line called Hamburg American Line, and the most notorious and the most criminal was Silesian American Corp, which is the company that used slave labor in Auschwitz, from Auschwitz after the U.S. entered the war and after the Holocaust began. And the name Silesian American comes from the coal fields of Upper Silesia in Poland, which is where Auschwitz was ultimately located. All five of those businesses, beginning in August of 1942, were seized by the U.S. government under the Trading with the Enemy Act. The mechanism that caused the seizures to begin was an infamous article on July 30th of 1942 in the New York Herald Tribune. It was on the front page of the New York Herald Tribune and also ran the same day in the Washington Post. And the headline in the Herald Tribune was, "Hitler's Angel has $3 million in U.S. Bank." There was a photograph of Fritz Thiessen, and the story reported the fact that Union Banking Corp existed and that Fritz Thiessen, according to reliable sources, was laundering money for Hitler, Goebbels, Goering, and a few other top Nazis. What's interesting about the article, which I have in my possession with the documents I found at the archives, is the fact that it references that politically prominent families were suspected in the dealings, but it does not name the Bush family, the Walker family, or the Harriman family. And that turned out to be very significant in the fact that what ensued was a 70-year cover-up. But as a direct result of that article in the Herald Tribune on July 30th of 1942, the government swung into action, and 3 weeks later on August 26th, Hamburg American Line was seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act. And then on October 20th, two more businesses were seized. On October 20th, Union Banking Corp was seized. A week later, on October 27th, Seamless Steel and Equipment and Holland American Trading Corp was seized. And on November 17th, Silesian American was seized.
Just one point I wanted to interject really briefly. By the way, the Harrimans were prominent American industrialists. They dated back to, I believe it was E. Roland Harriman, who was one of the robber barons who developed his fortune making, investing in American railroads. John, one of the people who figured very prominently in the development of the U.S. intelligence community, and he had his fingers very much sunk into this Nazi American industrial and financial pie. That's a fellow named Alan Dulles. Tell us how he relates to these Bush Nazi businesses.
They are very, very significant to the story. Alan Dulles was an operative of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which ultimately became the CIA. And as history would have it, Alan Dulles ended up as the station chief in Berlin when the Third Reich fell. His brother, John Foster Dulles, who went on to become Secretary of State, was the U.S. attorney for I.G. Farben and other significant Nazi interests and represented informally Fritz Thiessen's interests at a very famous New York law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell on the domestic side under John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles in Berlin largely destroyed the documents that would fully document this story and would have led to the trial for treason of Walker Bush and the Harrimans. Alan Dulles befriended and became de facto intelligence partners with a Nazi war criminal named Reinhard Gehlen, who I'm sure many of your listeners are also familiar with. For 50 years, the CIA has denied the fact that Reinhard Gehlen was in fact the creator of the CIA and that the CIA was largely created with Nazi war criminals, including Klaus Barbie, who the Office of Strategic Services under Alan Dulles helped smuggle out of Germany. But 2 weeks ago, UPI ran a story worldwide that in a response to a court case, the CIA has finally admitted after 50 years that Reinhard Gehlen played a significant role in the founding of the CIA. And so not only were the Walkers, Harrimans, and Prescott Bush guilty of treason, but they were in effect guilty of subversion of the American government by smuggling Nazi war criminals into the U.S. The other piece of the Nazi war criminal puzzle, which I'm sure many of your listeners and you are intimately familiar with, is Operation Paperclip. The U.S. didn't even take a breath after the end of World War II and immediately decided that our former ally, the Soviet Union, was now our enemy and that we had communism to fear, which became the genesis of the Cold War. Using that mentality as an excuse, the U.S. government and the CIA created Operation Paperclip, which brought in many prominent Nazi scientists to create our defense program and our missile program, which became the missile program that built the nuclear weapons program for the Cold War.
Yes, indeed.
Including Wernher von Braun.
Wernher von Braun is actually a major in the SS. He's gone down as being some kind of just a wonderful technocrat, but he was a whole lot more than that. At least if one views SS officers as technocrats, then he was a technocrat, but many feel he was far more than that.
And there's a very important subtle point there that I think needs to be made, which many of your listeners may be unfamiliar with, which I have seen some documentation on from the archives. And that is that even though we won World War II, the war was so brutal and the carnage was so extreme that the inner sanctum of the U.S. government immediately upon victory in World War II came to the conclusion that we weren't tough enough to withstand the threat of communism. And their justification, believe it or not, if you don't know this, and you probably do, but their justification for bringing in Nazi war criminals secretly into the United States was that they manifested the toughness that we didn't have in our national character. And just as the Bush administration now is putting people into concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay and torturing and murdering people at Abu Ghraib and Bagram prison in Afghanistan, that any extreme activity under the banner of national security can be justified. And I think that's one of the factors from the Bush-Nazi story and the era of the end of World War II that is anything but obscure history. It is critically important that the American people understand the dirty laundry in our national closet and that it needs to be aired for us to be able to face what we have become and what we're doing to innocent Iraqi civilians as we speak.
John, I'm going to interject a passage from a book that was written by an author whose work in many ways supplements yours. It's a fellow named Paul Manning, who was one of Murrow's boys in World War II. He wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, about the Nazi flight capital program at the end of World War II. And what I'm going to do is read a short excerpt from the actual minutes which Paul Manning had, the translated minutes of a meeting that took place on August 10th, 1944, SS General Dr. Scheid, S-C-H-E-I-D, acting as a proxy for Martin Bormann, was describing the Nazis' plans for a post-war revival. And now quoting directly from page 25 of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, Dr. Scheid also affirmed, "The ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war. As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheid cited the fact that patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., was thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern." And here's the part that I found most fascinating. He also cited the Zeiss and Leica companies and the Hamburg America line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Now, this is the discussion from the minutes for how to revive Nazism after the war, and they say, basically, Dr. Scheid gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Last time I checked, New York wasn't in Germany or Nazi-occupied Europe. John, one of the things I found most startling about your series in the New Hampshire Gazette was not just that you found Prescott Bush Sr. and George Herbert Walker involved with Nazi business, but you talk in particular about their involvement with individuals and institutions from 1945 to 51 who were moving Nazi money out of Europe in just the fashion that was anticipated there by Dr. Scheid. I wonder if you would develop that further for us.
Absolutely. Now, in that case, as I mentioned at the beginning, in the case of the documents that I found September 17th in one day, all I could really claim was that I became the first reporter in U.S. history, as John Loftus, author of Secret War Against the Jews and a former U.S. Justice Department Nazi war crimes prosecutor, has acknowledged publicly. I became the first U.S. reporter to ever actually see the documents and then report the story in a so-called reputable U.S. newspaper. But what happened was that I had planned to be there for 3 days, and I had been rained out by a hurricane, and I sat in a hotel on the 18th and 19th of September, so I came home to Miami with that first batch of documents that confirmed the five seizures in 1942. And every good journalist, as you know, or anybody who's good at anything they do, has a certain set of instincts, and I just had this feeling that if I had found that much stuff and come home with 200-odd pages of authenticated copies from the National Archives from one eight-hour day, and I had not been to the Library of Congress yet, as Miss Blackerby had told me, I would find even more stuff, that I should go back to Washington. So I went back on September 29th and 30th and October 1st. And when I went back on September 29th, and so I went to the Library of Congress on September 29th, and then to the archives on September 30th and October 1st. And when I went back to the archives, I became the first reporter in history to see the documents that had just been declassified on September 13th. Two weeks before I got there, that the Nazi dealings had continued from 1942 after the first five seizures until 1951 when Fritz Thiessen died in Argentina. The context that needs to be understood about that discovery was that I have in my possession dozens and dozens of pages of documents from the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Treasury Department detailing the extent of the cover-up and the lies that they told regarding the seizures in 1942. The most incredible being Fritz Thiessen's hand-picked man who was sent over from Germany in 1923. to watch over his money in dealing with Walker Bush and the Harrimans was named Cornelius Levens. And Cornelius Levens, who was Thiessen's hand-picked guy from 1923 until after the war, denied that he even knew who Thiessen was. Thiessen's bank in Holland, that was the connection on the other end for the money laundering, he denied he even knew who the bank was, had any interest in the bank in Holland, etc. And Bush and Roland Harriman wrote letters and stuff defending Cornelius Levens and that he was innocent and these charges were outrageous and they were only doing business with neutral citizens of Holland. They had no connections to Nazi Germany and all of that. And the FBI and Justice Department issued cease and desist memos that because their assets were seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act and that the U.S. had already entered the war, that they were, in fact, guilty of treason. Well, not only did they not cease and desist, but I have documents that prove that after the war, they moved Nazi assets into Switzerland, Brazil, Argentina, Panama, and Chile. And I don't think you have a listener out there who doesn't understand that, especially in the case of Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, we're talking about, you know, dozens of books that were written about how Nazi assets were cloaked in South America even before the end of the war, and that the living two-thirds of the Third Reich that escaped to those countries and were hunted by the Israelis and others for decades to come. So we're talking about collaboration in the greatest crime in human history, and we're talking about culpability in that crime by the grandfather and great-grandfather of the incumbent president of the United States. And to this day, Dave, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the three major television networks will not even look at the documents. And that's something I'd like to talk about as we get into the story, because I would like to implore your listeners to call Bill Keller at the New York Times and to demand that the New York Times get on this story before November 2nd so that the American people have to reckon with the history of this family and to, God willing, see that history is repeating itself. And we're on the verge, if these people are reelected, of seeing a holocaust against the Muslims. And that, to me, is the relevance of my reporting, and that, to me, is the relevance of the history.
Well, there are a great many things that we have to touch on, and we're going to touch on as many of them as we can inside, too, including your new book, a new trove of documents that you've just accessed. We're also going to relate some of the things that have come out of your first effort. However, we're going to do that inside, too. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a linked URL available for download only. Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. All kinds of links, descriptions for the various For the Record programs, article length, annotated descriptions, and links to various websites, including a website with Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, another website inspired directly by the work of John Buchanan that we're going to talk about inside two, and also that the Spitfire website has a search function. We have been speaking with John Buchanan, the author of a forthcoming book and also some New Hampshire Gazette articles that we've used in the past. We're going to be visiting with John in the second side of our program. This concludes, however, side one of For the Record program number 481, interview with John Buchanan, being recorded on October 9th of 2004. For John Buchanan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 481, an interview with John Buchanan, being recorded on October 9th of the year 2004. And once again, it's my pleasure to bring back to our airwaves John Buchanan. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to continue the discussion.
Now, we were talking about your articles for the New Hampshire Gazette, in which you accessed declassified U.S. government documents that prove the involvement of the Bush family with Nazi industry. There have been a number of things that have come out as a result of those articles that you published in the New Hampshire Gazette. One of them, very happily, was an enterprising website put together by some listeners to this program in the Midwest. Tell us about that.
There's an organization called the National Association of Critically Thinking Teenagers, and I was contacted by a couple of teachers in the Midwest who are listeners of your program who are involved with that organization and who had become aware of my stories in the New Hampshire Gazette. So they were interested in not only the educational aspects of bringing the story to teenagers in high school history classes, but more importantly, they were interested in having these teenagers work on a project of actually posting all of my documents on a website so that the American people and journalists and news organizations could see for themselves. Not only did they accomplish that, but they did a masterful job, and the website is www.debatecomics.org/Bush Family Fortune. Debate Comics, like comic magazine, debatecomics.org/Bush Family Fortune. And so your listeners and anyone else who has an interest in knowing the truth about this story can spend a few hours reading all of the documents and reaching their own conclusion about what they mean and what the implications are for the present era of the Bush regime.
Indeed. Once again, that address, and by the way, it is linked to the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The address, once again, is www.debatecomics, one word, debatecomics.org, /Bush Family Fortune, one word, but with the B in Bush and the F in family and fortune capitalized. And then there's a link to the Spitfire website so you can access work that was a follow-up, a wonderful follow-up, to the heroic work done by John Loftus in the New Hampshire Gazette. And that website also features copyrighted introductions to the documents by you.
Correct, right. I had written cover sheets for each batch of documents to explain very briefly in a paragraph or two what you're going to be looking at with the next batch of documents. So they posted everything, so it's very clear and simple to navigate your way through.
And in addition to that very gratifying feedback, and by the way, I would hold up those listeners in the Midwest to the rest of the listening audience as examples, archetypes for the civic action that I think is going to be required for people to relieve ourselves from the current malaise, and it is considerable. But that's the way to go. Just enterprise, undertake to do stuff, and stuff will get done. John, as a result of your New Hampshire Gazette articles, you've had other types of feedback that were less gratifying than what our listeners in the Midwest have put together. Tell us about some of the harrowing experiences that you've had as a result of the New Hampshire Gazette.
Well, what happened, the link between the two phases was that my first Bush Nazi article was published in the New Hampshire Gazette on Friday, October 10th of 2003. And on Monday morning, over that first weekend of the 11th and 12th of October, the story sprang up on about 75 major websites all over the world, including Take Back the Media, Rents.com, Buzzflash.com, and a few others in the U.S. And so the story got a lot of traction right off the bat. And on Monday morning, October 13th, I got a phone call from John McConnell, the 89-year-old founder of Earth Day, who lives in Denver. And strangely enough, based on his having read the Bush Nazi article over the weekend, he told me that I was the kind of person who had the courage and conviction to change the country and that I should run for president. I just count to him in the first conversation as a kooky old man, but I found out that he was in fact the founder of Earth Day and that he had known 33 Nobel Prize winners in his lifetime. And over the next several weeks, he, as a Republican, convinced me to run for president against Bush in the New Hampshire primary as a journalist, not as a politician, as the truth candidate, to try to force the issue that the American people understand and accept the Nazi past of the family. So I left on January 2nd and I moved up to New Hampshire to run against Bush in the New Hampshire Republican primary. I performed a minor political miracle, which was by talking every day about the Bush family's Nazi past and not my economic plan. I tied for second place in the New Hampshire primary and, in fact, beat 12 other Republican candidates. And as a result of that, I was asked to speak at the National Press Club on February 4th, and I stayed up in New Hampshire. So on the morning of Wednesday, February 4th, I flew down from Manchester, New Hampshire, Southwest Airlines to Baltimore, Washington to speak at the National Press Club. And when I arrived at noon at Baltimore, Washington Airport, I was taken off of my flight by two men who were introduced to me by someone who claimed to be from the Baltimore, Washington Airport Police that the Secret Service wanted to talk to me. Needless to say, my heart rose into my throat and my voice rose to an operatic range by the time I stepped off the airplane, but I did muster enough courage to ask them to show me some identification. There were two of them, a blonde good cop and a brunette, dark-haired, very menacing bad cop. The bad cop, so-called Secret Service agent, said to me, these badges hanging on our belts are the only identification you need to see. You are in deep, deep trouble. They led me into an interrogation room that is now believed to have been an INS interrogation facility, and they viciously interrogated me for 2.5 hours, claiming that they had a tip, an anonymous tip from New Hampshire, that I was leading a plot to assassinate Bush. After 2.5 hours, they let me go, and I went and made my speech at the press club that night. The next morning, February 5th, I woke up and came up with the bright idea of going as a Republican presidential candidate to the Capitol and demanding a meeting with the Republican staff of the House Judiciary Committee, and I did that. And I met for 2 hours with a general counsel whose name was Rob Tracy, T-R-A-C-C-I, and a Republican investigator named Thad Bingell, B-I-N-G-E-L. They listened to me for 2 hours. They went online and saw the Bush Nazi stories. They went online and saw my presidential website. And they promised me a congressional inquiry into what had happened. They never responded to my phone calls or emails ever again, which is probably no surprise to you and your listeners. It was something of a surprise to me. At the end of the two-hour meeting, they asked me what I was most afraid of. And I said, well, to be honest, what I'm most afraid of is that I've lived in New Hampshire for 5 weeks, and I'm very afraid that since this happened, that I'll go home to Miami and get arrested for something I didn't do. I'm going home to Jeb Bush's state, and I've been out making speeches about the fact that his brother is a war criminal and a descendant of Nazi sympathizers. And they both went off, you see, John, now you've turned into a conspiracy nut. Why would anybody arrest you? I rode the train home that afternoon of February 5th. I got home to Miami late on the afternoon of Friday, February 6th. And on Tuesday morning, February 10th, I was arrested in my apartment on 14 counts of aggravated felony stalking against a victim they could never produce in court. I was dragged into court four times between my arraignment in early March and my trial on August 16th. And even my public defender betrayed me. And when I went to Miami the final time on August 11th, and my own attorney, my public defender, said to me, well, John, I've got some really bad news. We've lost your defense. You have no defense. Your witness list and your alibi list, et cetera, have been mysteriously lost, and there's an excellent chance you're going to go to prison, and I really don't know what to tell you. So I begged her, I don't know what to do. I'm innocent. I'm going to go to prison for something I didn't do. Please help me. And she actually looked at me and said, I really don't have time to talk to you. I'm due back in court. I'll see you Monday morning for your trial. I just went into shock, Dave, and so I called someone I've gotten to know, an activist named Gabriel Day in Northern California, and he reassured me that he would get involved and help me. And so overnight, on the night of August 11th, he got together a committee to defend John Buchanan, and within 24 hours, through the National Lawyers Guild, they got me a wonderful attorney, a woman named Rae Sharon, R-A-E, Sharon, S-H-E-A-R-N, in Miami, through the National Lawyers Guild. She and I spoke by phone on Friday. She got the court file and reviewed my case over the weekend, and over the weekend told me that, you know, I had to realize that it was very rare for a state to dismiss felony charges against a defendant that the state actually wanted to try, but that based on the court file, my case was an outrageous miscarriage of justice, and that we would give it the best shot we could, but I had to be prepared for the fact that, you know, maybe they would put me on trial. And so we went to court Monday morning, August 16th. The judge still refused to dismiss the charges based on the objection of the state's attorney, who characterized me as a violent criminal who was a menace to the community. And Rae Sharon, God bless her, said, "Your Honor, I have a capital murder case starting tomorrow, and I'm going to be indisposed for the next 6 weeks, and Mr. Buchanan has been maligned by the court, and therefore we demand to go to trial today. We're ready for trial." Well, I almost dropped dead because I already knew that my defense file was missing, and I had no defense. And so the judge set the trial for 1:30 on August 16th. I sat in the courtroom and waited for 2 hours. We went to trial at 1:30, and my charges were dismissed at 1:34 because there was no victim, no witness, no cop, no evidence, no nothing. And the judge dismissed the charges against me and apologized to me. And I now intend to sue Miami-Dade County and the Miami Beach Police Department for malicious prosecution and to try to prosecute the cop criminally for committing perjury and filing a false police report against me.
So in other words, they did not give you either the Pulitzer Prize nor the Congressional Medal of Honor.
By a long shot. You don't seem like a guy famous for understatement, but that's an understatement.
All right. Obviously, it was deliberately so. John, you fortunately, that ordeal did not deter you from further efforts. You have been ferreting out more documents concerning the Bush family's Nazi connections. I wonder if next we could focus on some of your latest discoveries. Let's start with the new documents that you've gotten a hold of. Tell us about the Bush family and I.G. Farben.
Through a contact that I got through the Berlin Bureau of the Guardian newspaper of London, and after more than a month of discussions during which I sent them a number of the documents, the most significant documents from the original batch, the Guardian did an incredible thing. They dispatched one of their most renowned reporters, a gentleman named Duncan Campbell, who actually came from Afghanistan, where he had been reporting on the resurgence of the Taliban. And Duncan flew over to Washington and met me in Washington on August the 8th, and on Monday, August 9th, and Tuesday, August 10th, the 2 days before I had to leave to go to court in Miami, I took Duncan of the Guardian to the National Archives and the Library of Congress and showed him the actual original documents, because being a reputable and a major world newspaper, the Guardian was responsible enough to realize that they could not run any risk that my documents were forged copies, and they wanted to see the original. So Duncan Campbell spent 1 day at the archives with me and 1 day at the Library of Congress with me, and they were prepared to report the story, which they did a couple of weeks ago. But the day that we were at the Library of Congress, and also the day we were at the archives, he went into Washington to meet some of his colleagues for lunch, and he left me alone for an extended lunch hour both days. So on the day that I was at the archives, On my own, I found documents. There are dozens and dozens of boxes of documents that were also only declassified and approved for public release in September of 2003. And they are the thousands of pages of documents from the extensive FBI investigation of the U.S. business relationships of IG Farben, the industrial cartel that literally built and was the backbone of the Nazi war machine and manufactured the poison gases for the death. They were a large chemical company of which Bayer Aspirin, or Bayer, is a direct descendant. And they, during the war, were also the operators and managers of the death camp at Auschwitz. And so on August 10th, the day before I went to Miami to go to court, I finally found what no one had ever been able to find, which was documents that linked Brown Brothers Harriman and Bush and the Harrimans to IG Farben and therefore to the death of the Jews and others at Auschwitz. Among those documents is a 1942 letter from J. Edgar Hoover to the Secretary of the Treasury, which directly links their business dealings, their secret covered up business dealings in the U.S. after the U.S. had entered the war and after the Holocaust had begun, to IG Farben. There was a German journalist, her name is Eva Schweitzer, and she had contacted me from finding me on the internet back in the spring, and she published this very week, as a matter of fact, in Germany, in German, a very explosive book called The USA and the Holocaust, and she had asked me to help her go recreate my work at the National Archives and Library of Congress to see all the documents, and so I had done that for her beginning last spring, and she had also seen all of the documents. She was also interviewed by The Guardian, and 2 weeks ago today, The Guardian printed a major story on the Bush connection, including the connection to IG Farben and therefore to Auschwitz. A week and a half ago, Eva went back to the archives on her own, and she found and has in her possession even more documents that show that Brown Brothers Harriman, in which Prescott Bush and the Harrimans were partners and shareholders, that Brown Brothers Harriman, in turn, were shareholders in IG Farben and therefore were complicit in the death camp at Auschwitz. She also found new documents that showed that, according to the FBI, Brown Brothers Harriman helped smuggle Nazi assets into Chile and were complicit in the cover-up of the smuggling of those assets into Chile. And Eva is in Berlin now talking to The Guardian about an even more explosive follow-up story. And I am now more determined than ever, based on the failure of The Guardian story, to get any ink in the U.S. to fight until the end to make sure that this story gets out to the American people, whether it's before the election or after the election.
All right. John, real quickly, we are running low on time here, so we're going to have to move quickly. The documents that you have uncovered, you've come across some interesting information about the Hamburg America line. Tell us about that.
Correct. Now, those were also those were discovered by me just last week. And I was in Washington ordering my book, The Attempt of Some of America's Wealthiest Families in 1934 to Overthrow the U.S. Government, Assassinate FDR, and abolish the office of the presidency and replace it with what in effect is a civil dictatorship. That coup attempt in 1934 was facilitated by a secret organization called the American Liberty League, in which Prescott Bush played an early role. So that means that Prescott Bush was complicit in a coup attempt to overthrow the government of the United States. Those hearings, which many of your listeners I'm sure are familiar with, were conducted by the McCormick-Dickstein Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, and I went there to just see those documents and confirm them. But in the same batch of microfilm that included those hearings from November of 1934, I found hearings from June of 1934 that were a secret inquiry into Nazi activities in the U.S. and included an extensive inquiry into Hamburg America Line, the first business seized in 1942, which I already talked about. It had been rumored and written about for years, for decades, that Hamburg America Line had smuggled Nazi spies into the U.S. in the late 1920s and early 1930s, that they had given free passage to Germany to American citizens who would go over and proselytize for Hitler and things like that. And I now have in my possession from the McCormick-Dickstein Committee transcripts proof of that as well. In addition to corroborating all of those decades-old reports and rumors, I also found the documents that show that they secretly funded a Nazi newspaper. They funded and backed brown shirt operations that distributed anti-Semitic literature in New York. They funded a Nazi group run by Nazis sent over from Germany called the Friends of the New Germany, etc. And they also were involved in the publication of a book reportedly written by Paul Warburg that suggested that the Jews were an inferior race who should be exterminated, and which was published in the U.S. and sold in a bookstore in New York City. And so I now have those documents in my possession as well, and I would hope that before the election on November 2nd, the American people on a very large scale in churches and synagogues and mosques and schools and colleges and workplaces and labor unions, you name it, by word of mouth, starting tonight, if the New York Times and Washington Post won't do it, that the American people on a large scale would become aware over the next 3 weeks that the grandfather of the incumbent president of the United States was involved in an attempt to overthrow the U.S. government, kill FDR, and abolish the office of the presidency and institute a Hitler-like fascist regime. And perhaps then they will understand, those who still claim that they back him and will vote for him, they will come to understand the significance of the fact that we invaded a country without cause and overthrew its president and are torturing people at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, and that our constitutional rights are being stolen under the Patriot Act. And perhaps then the American people, especially Republicans and evangelical Christians, will come to understand that we are in a very grave set of circumstances, and that the pattern of behavior that led to Nazi Germany is repeating itself in 2004, and we can do something to stop them before it is too late. That is my dream, and that is my only goal and my only motivation in being on the radio with you or talking to anyone else I can talk to for the next 3 weeks, day or night.
And so summing up, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee documents that you've accessed describe those various Nazi activities in the U.S. prior to the war, and they also document Prescott Bush Sr.'s involvement with the Liberty League, and that was the consortium of fascist industrialists and financiers who tried to overthrow Roosevelt in 1934.
And the interesting connection there is the Bush family connection to Remington Arms, which was owned by the DuPont family. The great-grandfather of this president, Prescott Bush's father, was Samuel Bush, and he was a war profiteer and collaborated with Remington Arms in World War One. And someone who Samuel Bush worked with in World War One, who was an infamous war profiteer and war criminal, was an American named Samuel Pryor, whose escapades in World War One were chronicled in the famous book, The Merchants of Death. And Samuel Pryor was a principal in Union Banking Corp, UBC, the granddaddy of the Nazi front businesses operated by Fritz Thyssen, and Samuel Pryor was also involved in Brown Brothers Harriman.
And as we've spoken about, the veteran listeners to the show are familiar with For the Record 475, talking about Remington Arms, their projected role in the 1934 coup attempt, and also Samuel Pryor's son and his attempts to coordinate with Nazi agents in the United States to overthrow Roosevelt in 1940. But your McCormick-Dickstein documents actually link Prescott Bush Sr. to the Liberty League and to the 34th Coup Plan.
Not the McCormick-Dickstein documents themselves, other documentation that's pretty well established that the Prescott Bush was an early progenitor of the American Liberty League. That's well established, but it's not in the McCormick-Dickstein committee documents. It is well documented that Prescott Bush was involved in American Liberty League, but that is not mentioned, nor are the Harrimans, nor are George Herbert Walker in the McCormick-Dickstein committee hearings.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
So you do have the documents, but they're not from McCormick-Dickstein.
Correct.
Okay, good. Real quickly, John, tell us about your book. And this happened to be fast.
My book is titled Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold of Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right. And the book covers, in a couple of chapters, the story of my Bush Nazi stories and how the New York Times and the major media would not and still will not cover them. It also, a section called Are We Living in a Neo-Fascist State, covers the coup attempt in a couple of chapters of 1934 and the American Liberty League and Prescott Bush and so on. But the real premise of my book is that corporations rule this country, that corporate lobbyists are the de facto rulers of this country and the instruments of subversion of the rights of we the people, that war profiteering has become the career of choice for Washington insiders and former government officials, that the corporate-owned mass media has failed to cover the stories that the American people need to know about to understand what is happening in this country, and that we are, in fact, descending into a neo-fascist state. The underlying premise of the book is that if Thomas Jefferson was telling the truth, which I believe he was, that we the people own this government, then we have abdicated our responsibilities of ownership, and we are very close to losing any pretense to democracy, and that the critical moment is upon us where we have to take back our government and demolish the two-party corporate state as it presently exists. The website for the book, which is the easiest way to get it, is www.fixingamerica.org. Fixingamerica.org. And I began today what's called the National Truth Tour with an event at Detroit University Law School with the National Lawyers Guild. And the most significant event in this truth tour is going to be 1 week before the election, October 26th, at the National Press Club. And at the National Press Club, I'm going to be joined by a Christian minister, Muslim cleric, and Jewish rabbi, among others, hopefully including some members of Congress from both parties, who are going to issue a joint statement saying that based on the record of the administration of George W. Bush, that it must be made plain to Republicans and to Christians, most notably, that he is unfit on a moral basis for re-election and that he must be dumped from office on November 2nd.
All righty, John. Well, we will be, I'm sure many listeners will be tuning in, will be dialing up your website to get that information. We have been visiting with John Buchanan, the author of Fixing America, as well as a number of intriguing articles with the New Hampshire Gazette that we've accessed in the past. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 481, Interview with John Buchanan, being recorded on October 9th of 2004. For John Buchanan, this is Dave Emery saying, thanks for listening.